Hello and welcome to another edition of the LinuxInstall.net podcast. This is episode number 105, recorded on Tuesday, April 8th, 2014. This week, we're going to talk about how we test out all the great Linux versions that we play with and we talk about on the podcast. Like, what do we use to do that testing? We talk about where we started and how we got to where we are today. Before we get to that episode, though, we would like to remind you that we live on your feedback. We really don't make any money doing the podcast. And so the only thing that we have to make us keep wanting to go on is feedback from listeners like you. So if you would, hit us up on Twitter. Hit us up on the Google Plus community for LinuxInstall.net. We're LinuxInstall on Twitter. And let us know what you think. Good, bad, what you want us to change, what you want to hear more of. Let us know. We'll try to help you out. But now, let's get on with the show. This is the LinuxInstall.net podcast. This is episode number 105. We are recording on Tuesday, April 8th at approximately, well, we're late today, 8:05 p.m.
I don't know if it's not, you know, the month 8, 5 day.
No, the month 4, 8th day of 2014.
Sounds like captain's log.
It does. I'm not going to do it that way, though. And with me tonight are two out of my three co-hosts. The obnoxious one that's talking to me is Mr. Greg.
Hey. I am obnoxious, though. I'll admit it.
And the one being suspiciously quiet is Mr. Walt Jivek.
Hello.
And we've shipped Joe off to PAX East. Or at least he's headed that way. I don't think it starts yet, but
yeah, and he didn't take me with him.
Yeah, I know. It didn't take me either. Took his wife. Like, who takes your wife to a comic show?
What? Yeah. That's I tried to tell her, I was like, can I just trade places with you?
Yeah, she doesn't go for that, I'm sure.
No, she didn't. Clearly, because I'm sitting here right now.
Yes. Right.
I tried.
Yeah. Anyways. So Joe's off there. The reason why we didn't record a podcast last week was because I was in Disney and I didn't have time to write up how to do all this stuff for the podcast for everybody else. So
thanks.
I got a week off too.
We're all dumb.
No, you're not dumb, but we're a part of the New Tech Podcast Network. And so I have some stuff I have to do now that I didn't have to do before. So I don't have that documented yet. Not that it's that hard, but.
You know, Brian, we were just talking before the show about, you know, things that have good documentation. This is clearly not one of those.
This podcast is not a well-documented podcast.
It's not a well-documented podcast. And you have nobody to blame but yourself.
I do. And I'm a stickler for good documentation. So I should probably fix that. I will actually fix that before I take my next vacation or I have to do a trip for work or something. So that you guys can do it without me, because it's really not that hard. I just have to take the time to do it. Anyways.
This is me getting aggressive with the host.
Yes, it is. It's all right.
The balance is off today.
What?
The balance is off today. There's no Joe.
There's no Joe. Yeah. It's not that bad. Anyways. I went at Disney, right? And I'm totally blown away. Disney has always been about efficiency, and especially at the parks, efficiency, get people in. They study all kinds of crap. They're very well known for studying how lines, queues moved, what's the best way to queue people, how to queue people without pissing them off, what level of stuff you have to have going on to keep them occupied so they don't notice that they've been standing in line for 45 minutes, that kind of stuff. They now have things so automated, it's absolutely ridiculous. They are trying to take people out of the equation at every possible turn.
That's because they were listening to the DevOps Mastery podcast.
That's what it is. I'm sure.
I'll just send them my money and I won't even have to show up.
Right. You'll just have photographs of you at all the rides doing all the things, and you'll have all the memories right there for you to look at but not remember. Yes. But it's crazy. Like, you walk in, they have like card readers, and they actually had, and this is what we were talking about this at work today, they have two-factor authentication to get you into the park.
Really?
What was scary was we were talking about the fact that we work for a bunch of different hospital systems, and even the hospitals don't have two-factor authentication that's that good. Right? So here's Disney, an amusement park that's just trying to keep you from ripping them off, and you have to have your card ID and a fingerprint reader. Wow. Now, given the fact that 2 out of 4 days, one of the 6 or 7 of us that were at the parks, you know, in my family, one of the 7 of us had issues trying to get in. That might be one reason why companies are a little hesitant to do it. But, you know, there were people standing right behind there just going, okay, let me look at my iPad. Okay, so I have your card number. What was the park you were at yesterday? Which actually stumped me when it happened to me, because I was like, what day is it? Crap. What was yesterday?
And then he's like, hang on, sir. He pulls out a biometric reader, scans your fingerprint. It's like, oh, you were 3 feet over that way.
I remember chipmunks.
Yeah. There was Mickey. And, you know, what else can I say?
That's nice and precise.
But it was funny. It was like, oh, my gosh, this is, like, so much more secure. Not to mention the fact there's security guards everywhere. It was so much more secure than most corporations I've walked into. There's a few exceptions to that. But to the most corporations that I've walked into. And it was just amazing to me. And not only that, but I could actually sign up. They do this thing called FastPass. If you've never been to a Disney park, what FastPass is you sign up for 3 different rides, and you pick the 3 rides that you want to ride. You get to jump to the front of the line on those 3 rides. It's broke out into hour sections starting every 15 minutes. So there's one, you know, like it starts at 9. So it's 9 to 10 o'clock, 9:15 to 10:15, 11 or 9:30 to 10:30. On, and it keeps going that way all the way through the day. So they just keep people hopefully not all bunching up at the express line and making the express line as bad as the normal line. Well, now you can pull out your smartphone and you can sign up for all of those fast passes. You don't have to do what I had to do 7 years ago, which was run to the ride that you want, use your ticket to get a fast pass, then run to second ride that you want and get the fast pass, and third ride that you want and get the fast pass. Now you can sign up for all of them on your phone. And it was the first day we were at the parks was the first day that was live. Hmm. Had a lot of the normal, wow, they did not performance test this at all.
That's because they were using OpenSSL and got hit by Heartbleed.
I don't know. Their Wi-Fi was totally saturated. You couldn't get any signal on the Wi-Fi. So I switched to 4G to see if I could get it to work over 4G, which it worked. But then I realized it probably wasn't the Wi-Fi, or was the Wi-Fi, but it probably wasn't any better than the Wi-Fi because the servers were so loaded with everybody at 9 o'clock in the morning trying to sign up for their rides. But it's cool. The app that they have is cool. You get, you know, FastPass information, park maps, personal locator, so you can go, where am I? And it tells you where you are in the maze that is the park. iPads
goes against Disney
everywhere. What?
That goes against Disney as a whole, because they want to keep you in that maze as long as possible.
Well, they do it because they go, here, it's really a here and now thing. So where am I here and now? And then it shows you all the things that are close to you, and it shows you the rides with the shortest wait time. So it's gaming you. Hmm. This is shortest wait times.
It's gamification, but IRL.
Yeah. Yeah. Very much. And it was funny to go from Disney, which is so automated. I mean, everything was automated. We walked into not really rides, but they're like 3D video shows and stuff like that that have like wind and, you know, they blow air at you and spit water at you and stuff like that to simulate to give you a fuller 3D effect in the theaters.
I have this ridiculous image of like these little kids, like these little sweatshop kids hiding in the background with squirt guns. And then and one of them's got like an air compressor and they're just like, get him.
Yeah. It kind of feels like that sometimes. And they were really cool, but the doors to all of these used to be manned by humans, and now the doors have big signs across the top that say, door will automatically open. Please stay beyond or behind yellow line or red line, depending on what theater it was. And then the doors open, and you walk in and sit down, and it's a mad dash to get a seat, basically. But it's like all automated, and it's totally like that. There's everything is totally automated. And then we go to Universal for the last 2 days, and it was like we stepped into the dark ages. Like, you guys spend every bit as much money as Disney does on your park, but there's no app. We were using paper tickets. I could have easily handed my ticket to somebody else. They could have walked in. Nobody would have known. They don't have anything like FastPass unless you're willing to pay $60 a day. And then you get to jump in front of the line on any ride once and do that across the park. But it's $60 to do that, whereas Disney doesn't charge anything extra. You just get three rides instead of all the rides. But it was so weird to see how – I know both these parks are very – I mean, well, Disney has four parks and Universal's only got two. But it was interesting to see how less technology there was at Universal versus versus Disney. So that was my fun. That was my week last week. Oh, and tons of things were powered by Linux while I was down there. I did see lots of Linux screens. And unfortunately, a couple of Windows screens.
Yeah, I was just saying, didn't you post a picture of a kiosk that was running Windows?
That was the airport.
Yeah, that was in the airport.
Wow. I'm like Windows 2K.
I couldn't figure out what, because it didn't have any signage on the side of the kiosk, so I couldn't tell what the kiosk, I couldn't even tell what the kiosk was for. It did look like it had one of the scanners for your passport.
Mm.
So I'm thinking it was one of the airline's ticket things where you could redo your ticket because it was in a walkway going up to the ticket area. And I know at Cleveland Airport, you can actually check in for your flight. If you're not taking any, you're only taking carry-ons, you can check into your flight before you get to the actual terminal. Mm. So that's what I thought that might be. But it was funny because somebody had logged in with Anonymous over VNC to connect and manage the server and very obviously just forgot to reboot the machine when they were done doing whatever it was they were supposed to be doing. Because it had the full XP desktop right there. So, But I did see some Linux stuff. It was cool. And of course, you know, I got to see but not go into the new Harry Potter world in Universal too. But that was kind of a tease.
From what I know, Harry Potter doesn't use Linux, so he's an asshole.
Yes. And then I saw then and got to ride before Walt the Transformer ride.
Yeah, man.
It makes you feel any better. I was sicker than a dog when I came off the damn ride.
Yeah, last time that we were there, they were just building the Star Wars stuff, so I missed all that too.
Oh, you haven't done that? The Star Wars ride actually is better now than it was 7 years ago. The Star Wars ride actually has 30 different rides to it. It's 30 different events. So you can literally probably go on it all day and hopefully never hit the same one twice, depending on where you hit in the cycles. But the theory is you're not supposed to hit the same one twice.
That's insane.
Well, you know, they own LucasArts now, so they can do whatever they want with
Lucas material now. But I'm just thinking, like, just that whole area that they own and what they do with it. That's nuts.
Yes. And that they do it so smoothly and successfully. It's very nuts.
That too.
I mean, it is a model of efficiency. They get something like up to 100,000. The park maxes out at Magic Kingdom maxes out at 100,000 people and in the park at any given time. So we weren't close to a peak week, so we probably weren't facing even 50,000. But during the summer, they'll have 100,000 people in the park at any given time. And they still manage to keep people happy, which is brilliant. Totally amazing. So, what did everybody else do while I was away?
You're looking at it.
Stared at me?
Yeah, you. I put you as my wallpaper.
Sweet.
I stared at it forever, and I was talking to it, and I was hoping you would talk back, but you never did. Sorry. I know. It's okay. I forgive you.
Yeah.
I'm actually looking forward to getting the new version of Elementary OS, which was, I think its code name is ISIS. One of the community members shot out a sort of like demo preview video of all the changes that they've been making, like as far as the interface goes, and it looks pretty damn awesome.
So what's the big benefit of Elements again?
Well, Elementary OS is kind of like the nice thing about it is it just gets out of the way of everything that you're doing, basically. And like, for example, when I installed it as a developer thing. So clearly I had to install all of the development libs, but I didn't need to install anything else. Most everything that you need as a developer is just there from a get-go, which is clear in most Linux distributions, but this Elementary OS does it, and it looks good. So if you like to have a development machine that looks sexy, this is the one for you. And I happen to like sexy computers because I can't get a girlfriend in real life.
And we're going to move on from that. I've already been mean enough to him, folks, before the show. I'm not going to continue it on the show. Sorry.
Just go with it, man. I need the beating. I need the abuse. It's been too long.
It's been too long.
Thank you, sir. May I have another?
Yeah. We can help you find that kind of girl if that's what you're looking for.
It's called Linux.
Yeah, there you go. No, it's not. It's called Windows.
It's called you're right. It's called Subversion.
Yes, Windows and Subversion. There you go. So what'd you do, Walt?
Well, early in the week, last week, I bit my tongue. And I bit Ouch. Through my tongue.
Ouch.
Wow. And it hurt. Because of that, I wasn't able to speak very well, so it's a good thing we didn't do the podcast, because I would have had to probably not be here. In addition...
It's turning into medical condition.
Just about. In addition, I then had to chew on the opposite side of my mouth, which had a questionable filling, which I ended up chewing through, and needed emergency dental work. So that was basically 1 week.
So Walt, the question is, how did Linux help you cope with your thrash tongue?
Well, what it did help, sort of, is I played with my new Chromebook while not being able to communicate most otherwise. And it actually is pretty cool. I picked one of those, the Acer C720s, right? Yeah. It was on sale, refurb, $150. So I was like, that's within Walt's impulse purchase price for gadget stuff. And didn't really think I was going to use it more than like an hour, to be honest, because I was like, you know, see what it was all about. But it actually runs really good. The boot time is 3 seconds, maybe, if that. It takes longer for me to type my password in. Once you're up and running, you don't have to shut it down. You just close the lid and it goes to sleep. When you open the lid, it's just back on. There isn't even a recovery time. It's potentially faster than, you know, most of my tablets. Compatibility, I haven't found any site. I mean, I use Google Chrome and et cetera for my regular dailies. So as soon as I logged in, all my stuff was there. Bookmarks were there. Google Drive files were there. You know, it was just like ready to go. Everything that I normally would do on a regular computer, I was able to do. Zero issues. I found a couple of cool apps to take care of, like, you know, terminal access and things of that nature that worked out pretty good. In fact, I've never used Hangouts as my chat client, but since I used it on there for a couple of days, I use that on my main PC now, as opposed to the original Google, I guess it was Google Talk client, right?
Yeah, that's what got replaced.
Years ago.
That's what got replaced by Hangouts.
Yep. So,
do you have to root a Chromebook?
No, there's a, what they call it, a developer mode. So if you want to do something other than run the default installation, it's different on different hardware. Sometimes there's a little switch that you got to flip. In the case of the Acer, there's a couple hotkeys you got to hold down when the thing boots. And when you switch it into developer mode, then you basically get a boot menu. And you can boot off of other devices. So, yeah, memory card, USB stick.
So does that developer mode stick, or do you have to keep enabling it every time you reboot the device?
Yeah, by default, you have to, it sticks, but you have to pick what you want from the menu.
Oh, okay.
But if you want to permanently overwrite the Chrome installation with, let's just say, Ubuntu, you can do that, and then it will just boot in that by default if you don't pick something else.
Hmm.
This particular unit isn't any more, or actually it's much less powerful than my regular Linux laptop, so I have not had a need to actually hack it yet. But, yeah, it actually works really good. I keep it next to the bed now. It's kind of my, you know, if I need to wrap some stuff up but don't feel like sitting anywhere else, machine.
So do you use the, there's a Chrome plugin that's an SSH client. Do you use that to connect to your Linux boxes?
Yes. And it works just fine.
Because I stopped installing PuTTY on my Windows machines and started using that.
Oh, yeah, yep.
Because I was like, seems to work.
Yeah.
Not on Linux, you know.
And in the case of the Chromebook, I mean, most of the stuff you run full screen. So instead of a regular 80 by 24, you know, window, you actually get a full screen, bunch of extra characters. So you see a lot more information than usual. The keyboard itself, it's very similar to Mac, where it has different hot keys. So there's like a expose key, so you can flip between all your apps, and like the volume and brightness are independent keys. You don't have to, you know, alt function something to get to all those features. But yeah, it's real cool. I'm happy with it. I mean, it's totally worth the $150. You know, I don't necessarily know if I would need it for any more than that, but I'm pleased for what I purchased. My only complaint, and I wrote it up on my website, was I didn't realize that this particular model with the Haswell chipset needs a cooling fan. And the fan is a little noisy because I'm used to machines that don't have fans at this point. In fact, my particular machine, I got a feeling because it was a refurb, it was actually returned because there's a bearing going bad in the fan. Because every now and then it'll rattle. But for normal web access and stuff, the thing never kicks on. I was watching Netflix and it kicked on, and I was charging the battery. The first time I had to charge the battery, it kicked on because, you know, the battery is probably getting a little warm.
Yeah.
But to be honest, I've actually not had to recharge it yet since I got it a week ago, and I use it for maybe 40 minutes or something like that every night-ish. So battery life's pretty good.
It does a good job of hibernating then, too.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
That's cool.
Yeah. They say you get about 8.5 hours out of a battery. So that's probably on track because I'm about a week in and I'm just about now going to have to be plugging it back in.
And then it charges in like a normal couple hours.
Yeah, like an hour, hour and a half, I think. Yep.
That's cool.
So,
very cool. So our topic. Sorry. Are you done?
Yeah.
Okay. I thought so. But.
Don't worry, Brian. Walt's done. Just plow over him.
Well. Well, we got to get this moving because, you know, we're like almost 20 minutes in. Anyways, so the topic for the night is how do you test out all the Linux versions? I get asked this all the time. How do you test out all the Linux versions that we keep talking about or that you talk about as, you know, when you're talking to people, like, you know, not doing this podcast? What do you use? What technologies do you use? What have you played with? What do you like? What did you try and hate as far as working for you for testing the various Linux distributions that you've tried over the years? And we'll start with the young one.
Why you gotta throw me under the bus?
Because you're young.
Wait, so what was the question?
You have the shortest list. By default.
I remember when I was a young one.
Yeah.
Wow. Click.
All right. So, come on.
So what?
What did you use?
When I was testing?
Yeah. Even now, what do you use? What did you use before? What do you use now?
Well, before, I just threw it on hardware. I would just plow over everything. Literally destroy everything. Never back anything up. Just blow it all up. This is where I told you you were going to start passing judgment on me because I seriously just would blow shit up. I would just, nope, done. And then I'd, like, a week later, like, I wonder where that source file went. Oh, shit. It's gone. Yep.
You got to do that, though. That's what teaches you to back up.
So. Well, yeah, that's why I figured, you know, let's put, you know, home on a different partition and not worry about it ever again. But that that knowledge only came after blowing everything up about 40 times.
Yeah. My other big suggestion for anybody who's starting out too is there's a program called Etsy Keeper, which will put your stuff into a Git or pretty much any other. Well, it has to be Git Mercurial, one of the distributed version control systems. It will put it into the version control system and then let you can back that up to another, either to, if you're doing like Greg was suggesting, separating your home partition from your other partitions. You could put it on your home partition, or you can take it off box, put it somewhere else. I usually store all my Etsy directories somewhere else too, on a secure server that I have that I can SSH to and get push Git stuff to.
Your military grade silo.
Not really. It's died before, so it's not that good.
These days I rely on virtualization for testing. Unless, of course, I do one of two things. I have a laptop that I dedicate to testing distros on. I mean, I don't distro hop like I used to, but there are some, you know, where if I'm testing a beta distro, I will throw it on a VM, or then I'll just throw it on the test laptop and see how that goes.
Okay.
But the laptop's got newer hardware in it, so I'm still finding like weird nuances. Like a lot of distros still don't play friendly with UEFI or, you know, the specific hardware that's inside the laptop. This just doesn't work for anything. I mean, and it's just too much work to get it to work. So then I just plow over and start fresh again.
I see.
And UEFI, can I just say, is an ass. I hate that thing.
Young one, it was the same way with CMOS and BIOSes before, so it will get better. That's all I can tell you. It's just not.
Well, I mean, we're in that cusp where it's like UEFI is just starting to get out there, and you know, people are like, oh, why isn't it BIOS?
Yeah, so because you don't remember. Well, are you running the Phoenix BIOS or are you running? Help me out, Walt. What was
AMI BIOS?
Yeah.
Was it AMI?
Yeah.
There's a whole bunch of them.
Help.
And some would work and some wouldn't. And yeah. Hardware compatibility for Linux has gotten so much better.
I can imagine. I mean, just even in the time frame I've been using it, it's been a lot better. So
you said you were using virtualization. Which virtualization are you using?
I use two different ones. I'll either do Xen, or if I want bare metal, or I'll do VirtualBox.
Cool. That's cool.
Xen's a little hard to set up, even still. I mean, I've used Xen for a while, but it's still pretty hard to set up sometimes, and I just don't really care to deal with it, so I'll throw something in VirtualBox.
Have you tried KVM?
No. Probably should, though, considering the fact that it's a little more popular than Xen.
Well, yeah, it's a little more popular than Xen. It's got a lot more of the distros putting their weight behind it, which is the bigger thing.
Right. Yeah, I'd probably dig into Xen before too long. I like bare metal hypervisors. I don't know why. I'm just a little more fuzzy to them.
Well, KVM is bare metal.
Right. I just haven't tried it.
It's built into the kernel. I guess it's not really. I was going to say VirtualBox is, but I guess it technically isn't. Okay. So that's what you're doing, or you've done, and that's what you're doing now.
Yeah.
What about you?
Well, as we discussed in previous podcasts, my nickname used to be Operating System of the Day. So
I'm trying to think how you'd abbreviate it. OS, OD, OSOD. Hey, you guys seen OSOD around?
Yes. So as Greg said, back when we were poor and only had one computer, I would just blow the thing away and put the next latest and greatest. And yes, it took me a while to decide, oh, home can go somewhere else and I can keep all my files. So apparently
I think that was the one thing coming off of Windows that really jarred me, was figuring out that you can put those directories on different partitions. And I just couldn't wrap my head around it for the longest time.
Yeah, it didn't make a whole lot of sense. if you're, you know, coming from that environment. I mean, to be honest, in the Windows environment, if you do that, usually would cause problems because everything wants to be on C. So,
well then you have to deal with roaming user profiles too. If you want to be proper,
yeah,
you do so roaming user profiles, and those are crap.
Yeah, the whole topology of there is no C, you know, and nope. That in of itself is a whole nother discussion.
There is no C, only root.
So once I upgraded a machine, 9 times out of 10, I would keep the old physical hardware to test on. But then as computers got more powerful, then like you guys, I'm sure we switched to virtualization. Originally using VMware Server when that was free, ran it on a Fedora, actually not even Fedora, when Red Hat was free, Red Hat Box. And then sometime along there, discovered VirtualBox, and probably when they decided VMware wasn't going to be free anymore. So then I used that for a long time, and now I actually have an ESXi server that I would use to test on. But I still run VirtualBox on a good amount of systems because, to be honest, the support default install on a lot of distros already has everything pre-installed that you need to run in that environment. So, you know, you don't actually have to load the add-ons anymore, or, you know, I can't see the E1000 emulated network card and you got to find the drivers, or, you know, whatever it is. Right. So if I just need a quick, you know, I'll give an example. So the Ubuntu beta 2 was out and they wanted to test some upgrade, whatever. So I spun up one of my old, you know, VMs for it and ran through the upgrade just to kind of see if it did anything. But I had that on a VirtualBox, you know, regular system. I didn't do it on any of my home for real installs yet, because, you know, I'm gonna wait till it's actually out. But that's about it.
Cool. So me personally, yeah, I started the same way you guys did. I actually was lucky enough that when I started playing with Linux, I actually was doing it as a job. I had been a Solaris admin and was switching to some of our stuff to Linux, mostly because it was cheaper than buying Solaris boxes at the time. You know, they were 10 or 15 grand, whereas we could get a PC for 5. So it was quite a cost savings to just buy a cheap PC and do that. And then I had all the cast off. I would, you know, when the company was going to throw out PCs, this was before everybody was donating their PCs to schools, when they would throw out the PCs, one of them would just happen to end up in my trunk for personal use.
Ah, the good old days.
I had that happen to me too at one point.
I'm just going to leave this next to the dumpster. There you go. When we used to throw computers in the dumpster before we had to recycle them properly.
Or take a hammer to them for security.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, actually, yeah, I still have friends that literally tear discs apart because they want the Neo whatever battery or magnets out of them.
That's a whole nother interesting conversation we can have.
Sure. Yeah, I know all about how well a bullet will go through a hard drive.
Yeah, I've shot them before, too.
Used those for target practice before. But, yeah, so I had a bunch of stuff. I mean, I started off with Pentium 75s. You know, I was rocking a Pentium 60 Power Mac, and I had a Pentium 75, like I've said before, for years as my firewall. The box just kept running, and it worked, and I didn't need it to do anything more than it was doing. It would let my VPN connections go through for work. At the time, I could only get a 12 megabit connection to Time Warner anyways, I think 10 megabit until I got rid of that box. But I just got rid of that box because I actually had other hardware at a certain point that could replace it for, you know, less power probably. Mm-hmm. That's been kind of my mode, is reduce the amount of power I'm consuming with all my computers that I'm running. I started off doing, you know, like you guys did, pretty much the same thing. Because I had that Solaris background, understood that you could put
different partitions on different, you know, put your home directory on different directories. But that was because of Solaris. That had nothing to do with Windows. And actually, I did tout it when I was first doing Linux and telling people about Linux. That was one of the things I touted is you can put your home directory, like where all your files are, on a separate partition, rebuild the whole system, and not lose anything. And that was like shocking to several Windows friends of mine at the time. It's not anymore because everybody puts their stuff on D drives, but
voodoo magic.
It's magic. And I did the same thing, you know, I blow stuff away. I wasn't as quite as big a distro hopper because I was trying to match what I had at work so that I could test stuff at home and I wouldn't have to spend all my time sitting in my office. I could actually sit at home and do fun things like configure sendmail to send very specific ways, you know, look at a list of people and decide that that goes to this mail server versus this other mail server. All that fun stuff I started off doing when I first started. Over time, I just pretty much like you guys have said, I just started doing more and more stuff with VMs. I had access to license keys, so I was running test versions of VMware. I actually had signed up and was getting legitimate license keys for testing from VMware for a while. I stopped participating, so I stopped getting them. And
that's the one.
Yeah, probably. So I sat there and set up an ESXi server when ESXi went free. I was like Walt, I was using the VMware server before I switched to ESXi. VMware server had some issues that I didn't like, which is why I switched, because I switched before it. VMware server disappeared or became not free. And I had switched to ESXi before that. And I actually built a computer that I have, my major ESXi box here, which has like 24 gigs of RAM and a Core i7 processor in it. I actually built that to run ESXi so that I could run as many machines as I could. Then with the latest version of ESXi, they kind of screwed me over and I can't really run a graphical user interface of any type to speak of. And I haven't found a good interface that'll give me all the control that I would want without spending the $10,000 on the server that should run on it to manage it. And so that sucks because I do things like I actually use it to burn my movies and stuff like that. I have 3 DVD burners in there that I can actually rip my movies so that I can put them onto my touchpad and other stuff for the kids so that they can watch movies while we're driving. And so I have all that stuff in there and I have Windows boxes that are all directly connected to each individual CD-ROM. So it's kind of nice, but I'm going to now get to figure out how to do that on OpenStack because that's kind of where I've decided to go. And I may not stick with OpenStack. I might switch to just using KVM because I am running on my personal laptop that I do the podcast on. I have KVM running on this. It does run really nicely, actually. I don't have any major issues with it as far as KVM. It installs, OSs seem to install okay. It uses a lot of the same drivers that VirtualBox does. So like a lot of the open virtualization drivers all work fine with KVM. So there isn't a lot to do distribution wise for that, like I have had with VMware in the past, actually VMware Player and VMware Server and VMware Workstation. I used to run VMware Workstation at work when I ran a Linux desktop so that I could run Windows, multiple versions of Windows for support purposes. But I don't do that.
He's in trouble.
I do VirtualBox on my work machines. So I run VirtualBox and KVM mostly now. That is my primary 2 virtualization technologies on my workstations. On my servers, I'm running OpenStack and ESXi, but ESXi is going to go away. It's just going to be OpenStack. And I'm going to learn how to set it up properly, which means I may have to buy a couple more boxes.
Darn.
I'm going to be like,
more hardware. Damn.
I'm going to be like Walt and have to start collecting small $300 servers so that I can afford to run the backend parts of OpenStack so I can set it up properly and run it on the 5 or 6 different machines they suggest. So that's what I'm doing. That's how I roll.
It's how B-Man rolls.
That's it. But I like, you know, one of the things we were talking about VirtualBox, we've all talked about VirtualBox. One of the things I like about VirtualBox is that as crappy as the interface is consistent from Linux to Windows to Mac. It runs the exact same way. It looks the exact same way. I know where everything is. It doesn't change or move like I was complaining about Windows products the other week. And it stays very consistent across those, which is a real benefit when you have to switch OSs and you're in a hurry to get something up and running so you can demo something. And it's cool that you can take the machine images and go, okay, let me lift it off this machine, put it on this machine, and point it at it. Yep, there it goes. It works. It runs. Didn't have to do anything to modify it.
Yep.
Which, even on VMware, if you go from VMware Workstation to VMware ESX, you have to run it through a conversion program to get it to go between their two systems, which totally makes no sense.
Yes, you do. And it's painful.
Very painful. But I also use... Oh, I was going to ask Greg this. Greg, have you ever used anything with Vagrant?
I've never heard of it.
You've never heard of Vagrant?
No.
Gosh.
I am one. I am one.
You are a Vagrant.
I know, yes, but yes. I don't even know what it is.
Vagrant is a build technology, more or less. It's a way to set up these Vagrant images, and then your developers can then download the Vagrant images, and it's the full development environment already built for them. They don't have to do anything except run it on ESX, or I'm sorry, on VirtualBox is the primary. You can run it on ESX too, but VirtualBox is the primary. So a lot of people have started doing, like, that used to do demo machines. I guess I never had any problems with people's demo machines, but I guess people did. Maybe that's just because I did VMware so much, and so I was used to how all that stuff worked, and I did VirtualBox so much. But I guess people must have been having problems because Vagrant has just taken off as this thing that everybody builds demo boxes, especially for contributing to server-type products. Because then you can set up the server and then just use a single Vagrant call, and it'll download all the virtual machines that you need and configure the network and do all that stuff so that they're all talking on their own private network and you can see how they work and how they're supposed to work.
I'm looking at this now. It actually looks really cool.
Yeah, I just learned about it actually last weekend. I was over at a friend's house, and he was saying how he was able to set up a couple of machines real easy because it was all auto-scripted. And I was arguing with him, well, it's not that hard just to install it and set a few things, but he's never used a virtual environment before. So, you know, it's just a Vagrant on or whatever the command is, and then auto magic, a couple minutes later, you got a whole dev system in front of you. Right. And he was talking about, like Brian was saying, when you're doing teamwork, you know, I might set my VM up a little bit different than somebody else's. You know, especially when you get into these multiple systems where they might need, you know, database server access, web server access, et cetera. Whereas with the Vagrant script, you're guaranteed every person who's working on that job will have an identical virtual machine. And then at the end of the day, you can actually just say Vagrant off. It destroys all that stuff. And then the next day you can pick another one or, you know, do whatever you need to do without having this huge library of junk on your box. So.
Right. And not only that too, but then if I want to push out an update to one of the Vagrant machines, I just tell everybody to do Vagrant off, Vagrant on.
Mm-hmm.
Now they've all got the latest and greatest version that I'm going to release to production, and I don't have to, as long as they followed my instructions.
Right.
Which is a big if.
But who does that?
True. but it's all based on VirtualBox, or it was originally based on VirtualBox. It now supports VMware and I think KVM. I hope KVM. Because there is problems with... I discovered this the other day because Vagrant also supports Hyper-V. And then I was reading through the documentation of how to set it up in Hyper-V because I'm getting a lot of static because I use VirtualBox and I don't use Hyper-V and I'm working for Microsoft VAR, so I should use Hyper-V. And I'm like, whatever. Okay, fine.
Not I'll free. Try it.
What?
Not free.
It is on Windows 8.
If you have, really?
Yeah. Actually, 8 or 8.1, I don't remember which one, but it is free now.
Yeah. I thought you needed a server version.
No. And that was that because that was my resistance. I was like, I don't feel like going through the request that we have to make to get the license key so that we can run it. I mean, we're licensed to run it. It's just, you know, you got to find the right person. We're a small company, so you got to figure out which of the 100 of us it is that has the access to the keys. And it's not that hard, but it was more work than I was willing to put in since I could just download VirtualBox in about 30 seconds and have it up and running. And I'm already familiar with it.
But who wants their job done quicker?
Yeah. But Hyper-V, I guess, it is completely incompatible with VMware and VirtualBox. So nice. You can run either of those and Hyper-V at the same time, which is funny because I used to run VirtualBox and VMware Workstation all the time together without a single problem.
Yep.
Never had a collision. Only trick was you had to make sure that they didn't both choose like 192.168.1.1. Other than that, you were good. Which is, you know, a couple of seconds worth of work. It's not that hard. So it was very interesting to me that, oh, well, I have to give up all my VirtualBox VMs if I want to use Hyper-V. And I now have quite a bit invested into these VMs that I've built. So, but I can supposedly turn it back off. So I'll probably just try it and then turn it back off. But Vagrant's cool. If you haven't used Vagrant, it's cool. There's a bunch of stuff like the Docker development team has a Vagrant server out there. Puppet has a Vagrant server out there that you can pull down to try Puppet. If you want to try out Puppet, if you want to try out Chef, I think the Chef team has one out there. More and more projects, there's a Vagrant option where you can just do the Vagrant, you know, tell Vagrant to go pull from wherever that is, wherever that server is. And they'll give you the link to it. It's not hard to run Vagrant, as Walt was discussing.
Yeah.
So if you haven't checked out Vagrant, go check out Vagrant. Virtual machine wise.
That's my homework.
That is your homework.
All right.
By the way, speaking of homework, how's Ubuntu going for you?
I already replaced it with Elementary OS.
So did you make it a week?
I made it 2.5 weeks.
So you just replaced it like over the weekend?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I just couldn't take it anymore.
What couldn't you take?
I liked the power management. I really did. I couldn't get into Unity, and then I tried the GNOME spin, and it's like they hate GNOME because it just never works right. It's always really goofy things that never work too.
I had some else. It's what?
It's new. This is the first time they have a GNOME spin.
Well, no, I mean like just installing the GNOME packages because you can do it that way too.
Oh.
Yeah, they actually have a whole like GNOME meta package that you can pull down the entire like 200 megs of the GNOME library with GNOME 3 and GNOME shell.
The first time I've heard of anybody having a problem, one of our podcast listeners that contacted me and I've been tutoring about how to do his resume sent me a thing the other day that he was having trouble with Linux Mint, the GNOME version, trying to get it to work with the 3 monitors that he has, to which I went, why do you need 3 monitors? 2's enough.
Right.
But anyways, that was just a little jealousy, that's all. But he switched to Linux Mint Mate, and he said, I installed Mate and everything worked. So he goes, there's something wrong with that release. And I'm like,
Okay. I don't know. I don't use GNOME 3. And at most, I'm only using 2 monitors, and it works fantastic.
So, but I also saw something, because I said something on the podcast before. I thought that Wayland was dead, and I saw something the week before about Wayland, and somebody had a release of Wayland.
Fedora has been pulling down Wayland packages for a while in their updates.
So I guess Wayland isn't as dead as I thought it was. It just looks dead from the website.
It's on crutches.
Well,
I'm not dead yet.
I'm like, wait for me.
What did everybody switch to? So, like, Ubuntu was the last holdout for not Upstart, but the other one.
Oh, System B.
System D.
So now everybody's doing System D. So Upstart's just like totally abandonware. Like, wow. Okay. I guess it makes sense. It's just the init system. It really should only have one. Having multiples is kind of crazy.
Fedora's going to be running Mir next year.
Okay.
That's right.
Anyways, anybody else have anything else?
You can be quiet all you want, man. I got my integrity.
Yeah, integrity, right? Whatever you want to call it.
My medical condition.
Yeah, integrity. That's your medical condition. Okay. All right. In conclusion, you can follow us on Twitter as @LinuxInstall. We also have a wonderful Google Plus community that all kinds of people are following, and a Google Plus page, which is out there. If you go search on Google Plus for linuxinstall.net, you'll find us. Actually, I think we are plus.google.com/linuxinstall.net. You can check out what Walt's doing over at Walt Jivek. Oh, I'm sorry. You can check out what Walt Jivek is doing over at jivek.com.
Yeah, that's right.
Greg Martin and that other guy who's blown us off is at whatimplayingnow.com. And my other thing is the DevOps Mastery podcast and website. Which I am having, huh?
I said you're gonna blow up, man. You're like really lagging. Yeah. Which I'm. There he goes.
Am I?
Yeah, you blew up.
No. Blew up. I'm so confused. Anyways, what should everybody go do, Walt?
Go play some Linux, and don't blow up.
And get your medical conditions cured.
And don't blow.
This has been a production of LinuxInstall.net. All original content produced in this podcast is released under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial License. Please feel free to redistribute it to your friends.